racial progress in American history has not primarily been a result of whites doing the right thing, but rather because blacks have struggled for every inch of progress and because certain conditions have had to be ripe for progress to be realized.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Today is the day that America honors the memory and accomplishments of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and also starts our celebration of Black History Month. So we're especially grateful that you are here to listen to remarks and engage in a dialogue with Professor Michael Klarman. The public debate in the political campaigns recently has seemed to focus attention on the relative contributions of the inspirational leadership of Dr. King and the political contributions of Lyndon Baines Johnson. And in that dialogue, it's easy to forget that not all was done in 1964 and 1965, and in fact, there is still much unfinished business in the civil rights equality search that continues. Michael J. Klarman, who is the James Monroe Distinguished Professor of Law and Professor of History at the University of Virginia, won the Bancroft Prize in American History in 2005 for his magisterial study, From Jim Crow to Civil Rights, the Supreme Court, and the Struggle for Racial Equality. Klarman, who clerked for Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she was on the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, has placed the court in the center of the struggle for racial equality. In his latest book, Unfinished Business, Racial Equality in American History, which he will sign following the forum, Michael Klarman shows how much remains to be done. Please welcome Michael Klarman.
Thanks for coming. I'm delighted to be with you on this day that we celebrate the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. I'm going to talk to you, as George suggested, about my book, Unfinished Business, Racial Equality in American History. The book has two principal virtues, if I'm permitted to say so. One is that I think it's wonderfully illustrated, mostly thanks to the efforts of one of the reference librarians at the law school, Michelle Morris. So I'd encourage you to think of it as a picture book. The other virtue is that it was published in October 2007, which is the same month that the Boston Red Sox won the World Series, and more importantly, the same month that the New York Yankees didn't. So I feel deeply honored to have published a book during that momentous month. It's hard, as you can imagine, to distill the history of American race relations into 50,000 words, which is what Oxford University Press gave me in the book. It's even harder to distill it into 25 or 27 minutes, which is what the Miller Center has asked me to do today. What I'm going to do is I'm going to offer 8 discrete points about American race relations and why and how they changed over time. I'll offer you an illustration or two of each of those points. If I had time for a 9th point, I would probably talk about why the National League doesn't really deserve to be represented in the World Series anymore, but I'm not going to have time, so I'm going to stick with the 8 points. Okay, point number 1, racial progress in American history has not been ineluctable. There is a kind of conventional narrative, I think, which suggests that there's been a forward, almost inevitable progress in American race relations. Going back to colonial times, the country had slavery in the North as well as the South. As a result of the Revolutionary War, slavery was put on the road to extinction in the North. As a result of the Civil War, slavery ended in the South. Slavery was replaced with a system known as Jim Crow or white supremacy. That system was gradually undermined over the course of the 20th century until it was finally eliminated through some combination of the Supreme Court's decision in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 and the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. I want to suggest to you that that narrative is deeply misleading. In fact, there has not been a story of ineluctable progress. There have been periods when racial attitudes and practices have regressed or grown worse, as well as periods when we've made advances. So I'll just offer two quick illustrations of this first point. Blacks in the North in the period before the Civil War actually grew worse off over time. There were several northern states that permitted blacks to vote in 1800, but disfranchised blacks by the time of the Civil War. There were several states in the Northwest, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, which by the 1850s had passed constitutional provisions actually barring free blacks from migrating into those jurisdictions. There's no doubt that as a legal matter, at least, African Americans were better off in the North in 1800 than they were in 1860. The other illustration I think is more familiar to you. This is the Reconstruction South. In 1870 in the South, African Americans voted in large numbers. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of black office holders. Blacks served on juries. Many states had laws forbidding various forms of race discrimination. 30 years later, Southern blacks had been almost universally disenfranchised. You could no longer find any blacks holding office or serving on juries, and the annual number of blacks being lynched each year in the South had increased so that it was averaging more than 100 a year. Again, there's no doubt Southern blacks were worse off in 1900 than they had been in 1870. Second point, racial progress in American history has not primarily been a result of whites doing the right thing. Again, there's a conventional view, I think, which is associated with Gunnar Myrdal, the famous Swedish social scientist who wrote an important book called The American Dilemma, which was published during World War II. And the basic idea of the book is there is this American creed of equality, which is stated in the Declaration of Independence, and American history has been a process of gradual evolution in which our practices have more and more reflected the ideal of equality stated in the Declaration. I want to suggest to you that that's not true. We have not made progress primarily because whites thought it was the right thing to do, but rather because blacks have struggled for every inch of progress and because certain conditions have been favorable for progress. And those are actually my second and third points. The second point is African Americans having to struggle for all the progress that's been achieved. And the third point is that conditions have had to be ripe for progress to be realized. So on the second point about blacks fighting for their rights, I give you two illustrations. President Roosevelt in 1941 issued a famous executive order barring race discrimination in government contracting. He did that largely not because it was the right thing to do, but because there was pressure of a threatened march on Washington led by A. Philip Randolph, the distinguished black labor leader, who was threatening to mobilize 100,000 African Americans to march on the Capitol as the nation was on the brink of falling into World War II. Second illustration is the Kennedy administration in the 1960s. The Kennedy administration ultimately got behind the bill that became the 1964 Civil Rights Act, not because it was the right thing to do, but because of the pressure of the Birmingham demonstrations in the spring of 1963. Americans were appalled by scenes of Bull Connor releasing his police dogs and the fire hoses on peaceful demonstrators. That's what produced the pressure on the administration to support civil rights legislation, which it previously had been unwilling to do. Third point, blacks demanding their rights is not sufficient. In addition, conditions have had to be ripe for racial progress. There are lots of deep-seated economic, social, and political forces which have contributed to racial progress over time. I'll just mention two of them. One has to do with the growing education within the African American community. After the Civil War, most blacks were illiterate because it was a crime to teach blacks to read and write under slavery. Of course, it's very difficult to produce a social reform movement among people who can't read and write. It's much easier to organize people who have basic literacy skills. As African Americans made educational gains, it became harder and harder to justify disenfranchising them or excluding them from white universities. People who are educated have an easier time imagining a different world. They have an easier time producing leaders who can mobilize support for social reform. So one deep-seated change has to do with growing education within the black community. A second important factor has to do with what historians know as the Great Migration of African Americans from the South to the North, which begins with World War I. African Americans were drawn to the North primarily by the opening of industrial opportunities that didn't previously exist. But one of the most important consequences of the Great Migration is that African Americans relocated from a part of the country where they were almost universally disenfranchised to northern cities where they could not only vote, but often held the balance of power between two evenly balanced political parties. In the North, blacks found better jobs and greater economic power translated into greater social and political power. There were better schools in the North, so blacks became better educated. And the racial mores in the North were always a little bit looser, a little bit more flexible, which meant that in the North, you could develop an organization like the NAACP, militant black newspapers like the Chicago Defender, which at that point in time in the South would have been simply impossible to accomplish. Again, I want to emphasize, it's almost impossible to reform a system like white supremacy, which was a nearly totalitarian system. It's almost impossible to reform it entirely from within. Blacks didn't have political power because they were disenfranchised. They didn't have economic power because they were mostly tenant farmers and sharecroppers. They had no social power. They had no physical ability to resist because of the threat of lynching and violence. Such a system can only be reformed through outside pressure. External pressure supplied by northern blacks who influence northern whites and in turn the national government is what ultimately enabled the dismantling of the southern Jim Crow system. That's how to understand the movement for anti-lynching legislation in the 1920s. It's white northern congressmen with large numbers of black constituents trying to pass civil rights legislation to aid the situation of southern blacks. That's also, I think, the right way to understand the NAACP in its first decades. It's primarily a northern organization because conditions are too dangerous in the South in the 1910s or 1920s to be forming aggressive NAACP branches. It's a northern organization primarily oriented toward producing racial change in the South. Those are some long-term factors. Let me talk about some short-term factors. It turns out, maybe surprisingly, that wars have been highly conducive to racial progress in American history. The Revolutionary War put slavery on the road to extinction in the North while temporarily weakening it in the South. The Civil War, of course, ended slavery and also produced post-war constitutional amendments that guaranteed African Americans a certain measure of political and civil equality. World War II, more than I think most people appreciate, although the last generation of historians, I think, have demonstrated this really beyond doubt. World War II was a watershed in the history of American race relations. I think we can identify at least four different reasons why World War II was so conducive to racial progress. One was the anti-fascist ideology of the war. Americans were fighting against Nazis with their theories of Aryan supremacy, but doing it with a segregated army. That gave many Americans pause, and they reconsidered their commitment to white supremacy. Second, the role of African Americans. Soldiers fighting for democracy, as many as a million blacks wore the nation's uniform during the war, and when they came back, many of them reasoned that if they'd been fighting for democracy, they ought to be good enough to enjoy some of it at home. Third, the continued growth in black political power as a result of continuing migration, another 1.5 million African Americans moved from the rural South to the urban North during World War II. That was having a profound effect on American politics by the late 1940s. Finally, the fourth factor is what historians know as the Cold War imperative for racial change. The United States and the Soviet Union, after World War II ends, almost immediately are embroiled in a Cold War for world dominance. The Third World, which both the United States and the Soviet Union are competing for the allegiance of, the Third World is primarily not white. And American racial atrocities and race discrimination are a principal item of Soviet propaganda. So when the Justice Department asked the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education to strike down school segregation, the argument that is front and center in their brief is a quotation from the State Department that racial discrimination is providing grist for the Soviet propaganda mills. As a matter of national security, you, the Supreme Court, has to strike down school segregation. As a result of these various factors coming out of World War II, you see dramatic changes in racial attitudes and practices by the late 1940s. Jackie Robinson, together with Branch Rickey, desegregate Major League Baseball in 1946, 1947. Harry Truman, in the summer of 1948, issues landmark executive orders desegregating the federal military and the federal civil service. There is a fourfold increase in Southern black voter registration in the decade of the 1940s, and by 1950, you can find blacks for the first time since Reconstruction serving as police officers in Southern cities, serving again on Southern juries, occasionally being elected to local office, like Oliver Hill, for example, on the Richmond City Council or School Board, I can't remember which. You're finding minor league baseball teams, even in deep South cities like Montgomery and Birmingham, desegregating, hiring their first black ball players by the late 1940s, early 1950s. Okay, those are short-term factors. The fourth point I want to talk about, racial progress has often been an unintended consequence of actions that were taken for other reasons. I'm just going to offer one illustration here, but it's a fairly weighty one. It's the Civil War. The North fought the Civil War initially to keep the Union together, not to free the slaves. The Republican Party was willing in the spring of 1861 to commit itself to a federal constitutional amendment that would have forever guaranteed that Congress would not interfere with slavery in the Southern states. That was an effort to keep the South in the Union. Ironically, that would have been the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. It passed Congress. It was on the way to being ratified by the states when the Civil War intervened. In the summer of 1861, several months into the war, Congress passed resolutions defining the purpose of the war, and the purpose was defined as preserving the Union, not eliminating slavery. Ultimately, of course, the war did become a war against slavery. That happened because the war was not going well, because President Lincoln felt as if he needed to liberate slaves to undermine the South's labor supply, and if you enrolled slaves in the Union military, you would thus facilitate the North's manpower advantage. But the Emancipation Proclamation, it's important to note, initially cost Republicans. They lost dozens of seats in Congress in the fall 1862 elections. And of course, the New York City draft riots in the summer of 1863 are an expression of resentment by working class Irish Catholic laborers that they are being conscripted into an army to fight for the freedom of slaves. The Civil War ultimately became a war against slavery, but that is not why the war was initially fought. Similarly, as I've mentioned, the World War II ultimately was a watershed in the history of American race relations, but that, of course, is not why the war was fought. Fifth point, whites have often had ulterior motives or objectives for the racially progressive positions they've taken. I'll offer two quick examples here. Republicans in 1870 enfranchised African Americans with the 15th Amendment, not primarily because it was the right thing to do, but because they expected, rightly it turned out, that African Americans would vote overwhelmingly for the party of emancipation, which they did. Second of all, after World War II, much of the racially progressive positions taken by the Truman administration and the Eisenhower administration were adopted not because they were the right thing to do, but for this Cold War imperative that I mentioned before. These administrations, for large measure, not entirely, but to a large degree, were pursuing racial progress because it was a vital component of the battle against the Soviet Union for the allegiance of the Third World. Point number six, there is an important, though I think not widely known, dynamic by which racial change has taken place in American history. I want to briefly explain this dynamic in the context leading up to the Civil War. The same dynamic, I think, is responsible for the racial change that occurred in the 1950s and 1960s. Here's the dynamic. The North and South start out with somewhat different, doesn't have to be greatly different, but somewhat different racial regimes. So, for example, the North put slavery on the road to extinction as a result of the Revolutionary War, while slavery, although temporarily weakened in the South, makes a comeback and becomes more and more entrenched. Now, the North is no racial paradise, as I've already mentioned. Blacks are disfranchised, they're discriminated against, they can't serve in political office. But there are differences. The North has largely repudiated slavery, while slavery is becoming more entrenched in the South. Southerners become more and more defensive and more paranoid that Northerners are going to interfere with their racial regime in the South. So, for example, Northern abolitionists are facilitating the escape of fugitive slaves, especially from slave owners in the border regions of Kentucky and Maryland. In turn, Southerners demand a more efficient fugitive slave law, which they get in 1850 as part of the compromise legislation of 1850. Well, what follows are these scenes that are highly publicized in the North, especially in places like Boston, where you have terrified slaves in shackles being dragged back into slavery, often with the assistance of federal troops, perhaps with thousands of people on the streets protesting that the national government is complicit in slavery and is reaching its tentacles into the North in order to facilitate the recapture of fugitive slaves. Northern politicians scare Northern voters with images of a grasping slave power. Most Northerners could care less about what happens to slaves in the South, but they are strongly opposed to the slave power interfering with their own liberties, perhaps conscripting them into posses to assist in the rendition of fugitive slaves. So Northerners become more resentful, they become more resistant to making these compromises with slavery. Southerners then get even more defensive, they require even greater guarantees from the federal government, so that by 1860, Southerners are actually asking for a federally mandated slave code to protect slavery in federal territories. This drives Northerners even further into the arms of the Republican Party, which is newly formed in 1854 in opposition to the expansion of slavery. More Northerners vote Republican. Finally, in 1860, they can elect a president without any Southern support. That leads the South to secede. Basically, the same dynamic took place in the 1950s and 1960s. The South had a system of white supremacy known as Jim Crow. The North, as I've said, was no racial paradise. But coming out of World War II, Southerners became more defensive, more concerned that Northerners were going to interfere to undermine their system. Brown made that threat concrete. That mobilized Southerners to resist the threat of racial change. Southern politics became more radicalized. There was greater violence, white-on-black violence in the South. When that violence took place on national television in places like Birmingham and Selma, it mobilized Northern whites to support federal civil rights legislation to suppress the Jim Crow system. Basically, the same dynamic that took place 100 years earlier. Okay, the last two points, I only have about 4 or 5 minutes left. The last two points have to do with the Supreme Court's role in producing racial progress. I'm not always happy to admit it, but I'm actually more of a law professor than an historian, so there's a lot of discussion in this book about how law and the Supreme Court specifically have or have not contributed to racial progress. So the two points I want to make here, the seventh point and the eighth point, are the Supreme Court has actually been on the wrong side of racial progress as often as not. And finally, the last point, even to the extent the Supreme Court has contributed to racial progress, it's often been reflecting changes in public opinion more than causing those changes. Okay, so on the first of those two points, as I've said, the Supreme Court, at least as often as not, has been on the regressive rather than progressive side of race relations. Before the Civil War, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Fugitive Slave Act, and the Supreme Court struck down northern state efforts to protect their own citizens from being kidnapped into slavery. In the infamous Dred Scott decision in 1857, the Supreme Court not only said it was unconstitutional for Congress to limit the spread of slavery into federal territories, but the Supreme Court also said that black people have no rights that whites are bound to respect. After the Civil War, the Supreme Court reversed the criminal convictions of whites who had lynched blacks or perpetrated racial massacres upon them, as well as invalidating federal civil rights legislation. In the early 20th century, the Supreme Court on several occasions upheld racial segregation and upheld southern state measures for disenfranchising black citizens. Over the last four decades, since the end of the Warren Court in 1969, more often than not, the Supreme Court has invalidated affirmative action measures and struck down systems, schemes that were designed to promote minority political representation. Just last summer, the Roberts Court ruled that it was unconstitutional for public school districts to use race in student assignments with the goal of promoting racial integration, which is an extraordinary perversion of the original understanding of the 14th Amendment by justices who profess themselves to be originalists. It's really only in the half century from World War I through the 1960s that the Supreme Court was reliably on the right side, the progressive side of race relations. Last point, I'll finish with this one. All of the court's rulings, whether progressive or regressive, have largely reflected public opinion. In 1944, when the Supreme Court struck down the white primary, which was the primary method of disfranchising blacks in the South by excluding them from the only elections that mattered in that one-party region, opinion polls showed that roughly 70% of Americans supported the idea of federal intervention against Southern electoral devices for disfranchising blacks. Opinion polls taken in the immediate wake of Brown versus Board of Education showed that narrow majorities of the country supported the Brown decision from the day it was handed down. So even when the court has favored the interests of racial minorities, it's usually been reflecting more than it has been resisting dominant public opinion. Now, in all fairness, if we're going to note that the court's progressive decisions reflected public opinion, we should also allow that the court's more villainous decisions also largely reflected public opinion. When the court in 1857 said African Americans, even if free, have no rights that white people are bound to respect, it was reflecting opinion in the nation. I don't think there's any doubt about that. In 1857, blacks were permitted to vote only in five New England states, which together had only 6% of the North's black population. In the rest of the country, blacks could not vote. Everywhere in the country except Massachusetts, blacks were either segregated in school or excluded entirely from public education. As I've already mentioned, in several states, blacks were constitutionally barred from migrating. The court was reflecting public opinion in its decision in Dred Scott. Same thing true in Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, when the court upheld the constitutionality of racial segregation. It was reflecting dominant opinion in the country. Even the Republican Party by 1896, the party of Lincoln, the party of emancipation, had largely abandoned the cause of racial equality. National newspapers barely deemed the Plessy decision worthy of notice. The New York Times reported it in a page three column on railway news because the case involved racial segregation on a railroad. Okay, I think it's worth noting in 2007, when the Supreme Court struck down the voluntary use of racial integration of race-conscious student allocation policies to promote integration, the court did so at a time that only 5 or 10% of the school districts in the country were still using such policies. Essentially, the court was invalidating schemes to promote integration after most of the country's school districts had already given up on the idea that the government ought to be in the role of fostering racial integration. Okay, on that happy note, I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
After I ask an opening question, I'll move to the back of the room, and I would invite those who have questions to please join me in the back of the room. And for those of you who may not have been to the Miller Center Forum before, we really mean it when we say we want you to be involved in the dialogue. So please don't be bashful about jumping right in. In addition to a large number of students and faculty members, I do see William Lee Miller, who has done some of the most important studies of the debates leading up to the Civil War, as well as a leading scholar of Lincoln's history, who will be presenting here later in the spring, and also Professor William Freeling. Bill Freeling spoke here in the fall on the latest in his study of the events leading up to the Civil War, and I hope that they also will jump into the discussion. Professor Klarman, you've commented that a lot of the progressive steps have occurred in the wake of wars. In the light of what looks like a regressive role in the current Supreme Court, do you expect that there will be any progressive steps in the wake of the war in Iraq?
Right. So it's an interesting question, and one point to make is to think about why it is that wars have tended to have this progressive effect on American race relations. And I think there are a couple different reasons. One has to do with the ideology that usually undergirds these wars. Americans fight wars to make the world safe for democracy, fight wars to establish a principle that all men are created equal, and maybe that has some almost inevitable consequence, ideological ramification for racial equality. A second reason is that wars generally shake things up. They undermine traditional status relationships. It's no accident that women got the right to vote as a result, direct result of World War I. Wars often have these kind of dislocative effects that undermine traditional patterns and relationships. Finally, the role of African American soldiers, both during the Civil War, to some extent during the Revolutionary War, and then especially during World War II, have enabled, I think, them to make claims on racial equality. Not all wars are created equal. Some wars are much more dislocative. Some wars are much more total. I think World War II and the Civil War and the Revolutionary War are probably very distinctive from wars like the Spanish-American War, the Vietnam War, and the war in Iraq. The war in Iraq is not in any way similar to those other wars. Most people at home barely notice that there's a war going on. You don't have a complete mobilization of society. You don't have millions of people serving in the armed forces. So I would expect that there will be somewhat different effects. There might be different ideological effects. I think one effect of the war could be to force people to think differently about issues involving sexual orientation. It was fairly widely noticed after September 11th that the military was dismissing some of the only people in the military who could speak Arabic because they were gay. And a lot of people thought maybe that wasn't exactly keeping our eye on the ball. If there were a Democratic president in 2008, I think most people think it's almost inevitable that the policy of don't ask, don't tell will be abandoned and gays will be allowed to serve openly in the military. Bringing it back to race, though, I think you're right. With the current Supreme Court, it's unlikely that there will be dramatic steps in the direction of greater racial equality. I think today's Supreme Court, at least the conservative majority, believes that we've already arrived at formal racial equality and that the Constitution doesn't have much to say about more substantive issues such as wealth redistribution, which is, I think, something that, since it's Martin Luther King's birthday, we should identify in the last years of his life. Martin Luther King, I think, understood that it's economics issues that you're going to have to tackle if you ever want to genuinely solve the racial divide in American society. So I'm not that optimistic that with the current Supreme Court, things are going to change. But again, the last point I just want to make is the Supreme Court, to a substantial extent, is a reflection of the larger society. So I don't want to blame the Supreme Court. I think there's very little impetus coming out of American society today to solve this problem of two nations in which we've made enormous strides toward racial equality for the black middle class, but we still have a black underclass, which everybody saw in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, but which the dedication to doing something about seemed to have evaporated very quickly afterwards.
Hello. I wonder if you think there's a relationship between racial discrimination and the movement to extradite people who have entered America illegally.
Like with many issues, issues that may not be about race on the surface often have something to do with race just beneath the surface. I don't think everybody who favors strong anti-immigration measures does so for racial reasons, but I think part of the constituency that is committed to bolstering the nation's boundaries, borders, that part of that is based on a racial hostility to the other, to foreigners. So it's not a simple question. There are a lot of issues in the last 30 or 40 years, which on the surface are not conducted in racial terms. For example, I'll just take one that seems particularly salient. The South in the last 50 years has gone from being the most Democratic part of the country to being the most Republican part. I don't think that's entirely about race, but I don't think you could come anywhere near offering a satisfactory explanation of that development without focusing fairly heavily on race. So I think the same thing about immigration. I don't think it's all about race, but I think it would probably be a mistake to pretend that none of this has to do with race.
Thank you so much for your overarching look at racial relations. And I know that we're familiar with the concept during slavery that anyone with one drop of black blood was considered black. And I wonder what you think of the idea of a wider recognition of mixed race and what that effect that might have on racial relations.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It wasn't actually under slavery that the one drop rule existed. The one drop rule is something that the South gradually evolved to in the 20th century, the early part of the 20th century, because I think the general explanation historians would accept is, while African Americans were enslaved, there was actually less of a need to rigidly distinguish whites and blacks. It's only once slavery was eliminated that it became more and more an obsession among white people to distinguish all black people from themselves. So you had these statutes, and I think Virginia's wasn't adopted until the 1920s, which tried to define someone as black based on one drop of blood. The point's an excellent one. The United States is becoming much more complicated demographically. Blacks are no longer the largest minority in the United States. Latinos are. The Asian American population has tripled in the last 20 years. The state of California, which is the largest state of the country, largest state in the country, is no longer majority white. The country as a whole will no longer be majority white by the middle of the 21st century. That's going to complicate people's views about race. You see it all the time. If you read the wedding announcements in the New York Times, which is a hobby of mine, you'll see interracial marriages all the time. One striking fact, however, is that other racial groups have assimilated much more quickly than African Americans. So if you look at the interracial marriage rate among Asians and Caucasians, I think something like 50% of Asian American women now marry whites. Among African Americans, the number is still down around 6%. And the same thing's true about housing segregation. African Americans are more racially segregated. Even affluent African Americans are more racially segregated in cities like Los Angeles than the poorest Latino Americans. So on the one hand, there's vast complication because you're going to have a polyglot nation. On the other hand, I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that at least African Americans are somehow being isolated from that greater assimilation that you see going on with other racial groups.
What is the role of common memory of the civil rights movement as a sort of war against the collective will of rabid racist Southern individuals in informing the ability of modern whites to deny or dismiss continued structural racism or race relations?
Right. So I do think it's possible, as Barack Obama has been doing recently, it is possible to take some sort of comfort or sustenance from the civil rights movement and what it accomplished. If you go back as recently as the 1930s, you will find a profound sense of pessimism among African Americans, even those at the forefront of the civil rights movement, like W.E.B. Du Bois, about whether their grandchildren would ever experience an end to formal segregation and Jim Crow. I don't think anybody in 1950 could have predicted that within 15 years there would be landmark civil rights legislation, that the Supreme Court would have come down against racial segregation, that Congress would have passed a law barring race discrimination in employment, race discrimination in public accommodations. Nobody could have dreamed, I think, 30 or 40 years ago that the last two secretaries of state would be African American, that a black man could very well be elected president of the United States in the year 2008. So we shouldn't underestimate how dramatic and unpredictable the changes that have already taken place. Now, on the other hand, having said that, I think in the 1960s, at the peak of the civil rights movement, you would have found many people being optimistic that race would play no role whatsoever in the American consciousness 40 years later, and that's just not true. So in the same way that people might have been more pessimistic than warranted before World War II, they might have been more optimistic than turned out to be warranted during the peak of the civil rights movement. But again, I would simply focus on the fact that the civil rights movement accomplished extraordinary change that most people would not have thought was possible. And that ought to remind us that it is possible to accomplish dramatic, even revolutionary change. It's not easy. It's hard for people to figure out how to duplicate what worked in the 1960s. But you shouldn't be pessimistic because it's been done before, and that means it can be done again. And that's true whatever your issue of social reform is, whether it's racial equality, sexual orientation equality, animal rights, whatever your social reform preoccupation is. It looks like the way things are is inevitable, but in fact, it's mostly a social construct and things can be changed.
If I may. Hi, my name is Chris LeBron. I'm a McWilliams fellow here. I'm a political philosopher. My work is exactly on this question of unfinished business. A point of clarification, you said two things. One, that the Supreme Court was most often on the right side of the issues between 1910 and 1960, and also that the Supreme Court, when it was on the right side, tended to reflect dominant public opinion. But the tricky thing here is that between 1910 and 1960, you have people in the South clamping down ever tighter with Jim Crow, and then in the North, you start to get a not-in-my-backyard reaction to blacks moving up North. It isn't a racial paradise. That process is being pushed forward by institutions like the homeowners, lending corporation, redlining neighborhoods. So in that case, I think dominant is not the right descriptor for public opinion. And if that's the case, then it's not also not the case that the Supreme Court's reflecting public opinion since it's not dominant. So then I guess the point of clarification would be is if between those the trickiest years you have the Supreme Court on the right side of issues, but it's not really being moved by public opinion because it isn't the most favorable thing happening in public opinion, then what actually does account for it? And I suspect that the answer is something you alluded to earlier, where there are certain situations such as that there are conditions under which, you know, the Supreme Court is being politically pressured to weigh in on the right side of issues. But I wanted to see if you could clarify that a bit more, because the two explanations don't seem to really jibe the way they might.
That's a terrific question. I'm glad you pushed me on it. Here's what I would say. The Supreme Court, when it intervenes against Southern Jim Crow, which is what it's doing in the years between 1910 and 1965, starting out with some criminal procedure cases, including two famous ones in which the Scottsboro boys have their convictions overturned, then striking down the white primary, striking down segregation in interstate transportation, then most significantly striking down public school segregation. Those are all instances of the Supreme Court striking blows against the formal system of Jim Crow in the South. And that's something that I think public opinion in the North is perfectly willing to sign on to, especially in the post-World War II developments with public opinion becoming somewhat more liberal. Now, your point is exactly right. It's not that Northern opinion ever really supports an end to the discriminatory practices that are perpetrated in the North, where the main problem would be housing discrimination, right? There are literally dozens of episodes between World War I and the 1960s in which a black family moving into a white neighborhood in a suburb of Chicago or Detroit produces a massive race riot with literally thousands of whites mobilizing in opposition to a single black family. Well, it's worth noting the Supreme Court never really takes significant action against the sort of practices that make housing discrimination possible. The court does strike down restrictive covenants in 1948, but the court has an opportunity in a case that I think probably none of you have ever heard of, a case that comes up right around the same time as Brown, maybe a couple years earlier, involving a large private corporation in New York City, which is building massive public housing units, sort of the equivalent in New York City of Levittown, and they're doing it with public money and with the public eminent domain power, but they won't allow black people to live there. And the Supreme Court has an opportunity in about 1950 to say that's unconstitutional. You can't build a massive public housing complex with public money and with the support of the eminent domain power and not allow black people to live there. The Supreme Court refuses even to hear the case. When Levittown opens in the late 1950s with housing for 60,000 people, not a single black person is allowed to live there, right? So I think the answer is, maybe that's a long way of getting to the point, the answer is the Supreme Court reflects Northern opinion in ending Southern Jim Crow, but there was never a national consensus to end the sorts of practices that were pervasive in the North, meaning housing segregation and school segregation, which flows out of housing segregation in the North. It is absolutely clear, based on internal discussions going on in the court in 1954, that when the justices strike down school segregation, they're not insisting that any schools be integrated. All they're insisting on is that the state not affix separate names to a black and white school. But if people all go to the school closest to where they live, and black people and white people don't live in the same neighborhoods, the Supreme Court in 1954 does not think that violates the Constitution.
My name's Jay Stewart. I'm a retired international executive. I bring a rather interesting perspective to this situation. I graduated from high school in 1954 from Topeka High School, which is kind of interesting because all the way through public schools, from kindergarten all the way through high school, I never went to a segregated school. And the misconception that most people have is that Brown versus Education was a a measure that which prohibited segregation. Well, there was no segregation, as far as I know, in Topeka, certainly, and probably in all of Kansas. I'll give you a chance to correct that record, if you'd like.
Right. So Kansas is an unusual state. There were, in 1954, there are 17 states which have mandated segregation at the state level. Those are the 11 states of the former Confederacy and six border states, the states that had slavery but stayed in the Union, Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, Missouri, and add Oklahoma to that, and I think that gets you up to either 16 or 17. There are four states which have what's known as local option. Those states have a state law authorizing local communities to have segregated schools but not mandating it. Those four states are Kansas, Wyoming, Arizona, New Mexico. Kansas is actually even more complicated than that because Kansas law provides that segregation is authorized only in first-class cities, meaning large cities. So in smaller cities in Kansas, segregation's not authorized by state law. And in Topeka, it's only authorized in grade schools, not in high schools. So the answer is there are actually grade schools in Topeka that are segregated. That's why the Brown versus Board of Education case comes out of Topeka. But in fact, it's a crazy quilt pattern where high schools are not segregated, and in small towns and rural areas, no segregation is allowed. And finally, segregation is breaking down of its own force in Kansas, so that the Topeka School Board is actually not even resisting the litigation by the time the Supreme Court makes its decision. Kansas, it's easy to abolish segregation. The problem is the court also has cases from Clarendon County, South Carolina, and Prince Edward County, Virginia. And in Clarendon County, South Carolina, 90% of the public school students are black, and it is inconceivable to whites that they will be willing to endure integrated education. In fact, they never did when a federal trial judge in the late 1960s finally ordered the schools in Clarendon County integrated. Whites just left the public school system, so they never went to integrated public schools.
Now, my name is Bill Miller. I'm admiring your overview, the summary, really so well done, also the detail now. I want to have a kind of contrarian question in spite of my admiration for your summary and agreement with it. Suppose you drove unintended consequences, right thing to do, through American history. If you took a view from world societies and you looked at the depth of the institution of slavery and then Jim Crow, and you said, could you not present everything that you did with a slightly different result, that here's something working all the time against this enormous resistance? It isn't just unintended consequences. We could go through and name the different, it would be a bit of a cliche perhaps, but the heroes of the all these battles, and then end by saying, really, it's quite extraordinary for the United States to come, to overcome the deep institution of slavery and the institution of Jim Crow, and a deep racism that those engender. That's the undertow that keeps things going back all the time is the depth of white racism. But given all that, then you have these movements which keep working away and make it somewhat better. Might one not give your whole talk that way?
Right. I tend to be a cynic at heart. You're exactly right that if I have said not a word about the abolitionists, whom I have deep admiration for. I mean, the generation of abolitionists who are following William Lloyd Garrison and beginning in 1831, they are banging their heads against a concrete wall. They're a tiny percentage of the population. They're burned in effigy. William Lloyd Garrison is almost lynched on more than one occasion. Those are people who are genuinely committed to doing the right thing. They're not trying to abolish slavery because they think it's economically inefficient or because they want to make the United States a beacon for hope in the rest of the world. They're trying to abolish slavery because they think slavery is deeply immoral, that it's contrary to God's law, that it's the right thing to do to end slavery. I don't want to minimize the amount of credit that they get, but you're talking about probably less than 1% of the population in the North. And my point is, they only become successful as a result of a combination of opportune circumstances and African-American militancy. Many of those abolitionists, of course, are African-Americans, although Garrison, of course, is not. So I think, Professor Miller, you're exactly right. One thing we could say is, rather than being pessimistic because of the limited change that's been accomplished, we could marvel at the fact that this incredibly deeply entrenched system of white supremacy, which virtually all scientists would have told us 100 years ago was biologically determined and people would have argued was justified by the law of God, that most of us today regard those beliefs as zany and can hardly believe anyone ever thought those things seriously. Maybe we should be really impressed by how much we've accomplished. I think that's entirely possible, yeah.
You began your narrative with a revisionist retelling of racial change, and namely that sometimes we get racial progress, sometimes we get racial retrenchment and regression. And then you sketched out some of the factors that would lead to racial progress: war, unintended consequences and contingency, public opinion shifts. So I want to push you to give a few of the factors and conditions that might lead to racial retrenchment, and then ask you whether you think we're in an era of racial progress or racial retrenchment or some combination.
Right. So I know we're short of time, so I'm going to try to give you a really concise answer. I mean, there's a conventional series of explanations for what happened to the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and maybe this is a good way in capsule form of answering, well, what are the conditions that tend to undermine racial progress? One, a diversion of attention to another issue. Between 1963 and 1965, in Gallup polls, Americans by large margins identified civil rights as the most important issue in the country. Beginning in the spring of 1965 or the summer of 1965, that was displaced by the war in Vietnam. The war in Vietnam not only distracted attention, but it diverted resources, and then it produced divisions within the civil rights movement after SNCC and Martin Luther King came out against the war in 1966-67. So that's one explanation. Second explanation, African Americans did the best when they were evenly dividing their votes between Democratic and Republican parties. Most people may not be aware of that, but between 1962 and 1964, African Americans were not in the pocket of either party. Before 1932, they voted overwhelmingly Republican. Beginning with 1964, with Goldwater being the Republican nominee, they voted overwhelmingly Democratic. It's never a good thing to be in the pocket of one political party because they don't have much incentive then to do anything for you. They can take you for granted. Now, I don't say that's anything African Americans could control. If the choice was voting for Lyndon Johnson or voting for Barry Goldwater, who was an opponent of the Civil Rights Act, of course they were going to vote for the Democrat. But just 4 years earlier, 30% of African Americans had voted for Richard Nixon, and 8 years earlier, 40% had voted for Dwight Eisenhower. You're in a much more robust political position if you can split your votes. The internal divisions in the black community, right, the rise of black power, the outbreak of urban race riots, this was undermining the civil rights movement from within, deep divisions. SNCC and CORE were excluding their white members beginning in 1966-67. Peaceful protest, being victimized by Bull Connor in 1963, was a much better way of winning white support than standing in a burning ghetto yelling, "Burn, baby, burn," and "Get whitey." Turns out that white people weren't real supportive of that. I think there are a series of factors you can point to that pretty much undermine the civil rights movement, and maybe you can draw some more general lessons from that. Diversion to other issues, internal divisions, political alliances, Also, the last point is that, you know, the civil rights movement was starting to focus on economic redistribution and an end to racial segregation and housing in the North, and whites in the United States had never signed up for that. All right, I think basically Northern whites had agreed that Southern Jim Crow and Bull Connor and the police dogs had to be suppressed. They'd never signed up for the proposition that they had to live in integrated neighborhoods and that we were going to have a significant war on poverty and redistribute wealth in the direction of racial minorities. So that's somewhat pessimistic conclusion, because I don't know how you get people to sign up for that.
Hi, Professor Klarman. I recently became aware of a case before the court this term having to do with policy in certain counties that seems to have an adverse impact on voting for African Americans because of showing identification at the polls. And this article said that some historians and law school professors composed a brief. Were you part of this brief, or do you know anything about the brief that was submitted to the court? And my second question was, do you have any comments about voting and race for the upcoming elections in 2008. Thanks.
Right. So the specific issue is an Indiana law that requires photo IDs to vote. And the law has been popular. Georgia adopted a similar law, and a bunch of other states are considering doing so. The laws tend to be debated in state legislatures entirely on partisan lines. Democrats overwhelmingly oppose the laws on the grounds that they will disadvantage minority and poor voters. Republicans overwhelmingly defend the laws on the grounds that they're necessary to defend against voter fraud. Interestingly, not only is the vote in state legislatures almost universally on party lines, the way that judges have divided is almost also universally on party lines. Republican judges have rejected challenges on the ground that voter fraud is a real issue and states are entitled to protect themselves against it. Democratic-appointed judges have almost all agreed these measures are unconstitutional or violate the Voting Rights Act, and that there's been no demonstrated instance of voter fraud in these jurisdictions. I think most people reading the, all I read is Linda Greenhouse's account of the oral argument in the Supreme Court. I think most people's view is that the Supreme Court will also divide along partisan lines, which means that the law will be upheld by a vote of 5-4. I don't remember. I think I was probably asked to sign the brief, but I tend not to do these things. Lawyers' briefs tend to be something that historians are not very comfortable with, because what lawyers do is bend every possible argument to reach a particular objective. And I don't think any self-respecting historian necessarily is willing to do that. So I think the answer is I was asked to do it, but I never sign these briefs because they're always a little bit disingenuous. In terms of race and the election, I mean, I don't have anything to add beyond what you read in the newspapers. I think it's really interesting that African Americans seem to be dividing between Obama and Hillary Clinton. And I think one question in the election in 2008, if Obama is nominated, whether African Americans will be so motivated that they will turn out in large numbers. On the other side, of course, is the question whether there's still significant numbers of people who won't vote for black candidates. We again had this perhaps disturbing phenomenon in New Hampshire that the opinion polls did not predict what actually happened. There's a history of that happening with black candidates dating back, you may remember, with Doug Wilder. He was supposed to win in the opinion polls by something like, or in the exit polls, by 5-10%, and he ended up winning by less than 1%, because apparently there's still a significant number of voters who will tell the pollster what they think they're supposed to say, but in the privacy of the voting booth still will not vote for a black person. Now, in Iowa, that wasn't true. It's not clear what happened in New Hampshire, but certainly one possibility is that something like that still goes on. It's an interesting question today whether a presidential candidate who's black will mobilize more black supporters or alienate more white voters who still can't quite stomach the idea of a black president. I don't have any particular expertise in answering that.
Professor Klarman will sign copies of his new book, Unfinished Business, outside the forum room, and I ask that we give him the opportunity to leave the room so that he won't hold up people who want to get his book signed. I was very distressed to learn that Professor Klarman is moving to the Harvard Law School faculty effective this summer, but after hearing his opening comments, I've come to realize that the Richmond Braves are simply no competition for the Boston Red Sox.
The Richmond Braves are leaving, too.
The Richmond Braves are leaving. Thank you very much, Mike Klarman.